I learned that I was to share this platform with the eminent Mr. Hochschild, who has just addressed you. I thought it was wise to see if we could avoid overlapping. And I sent him a copy of more or less what I had said on this subject in a lecture in London, and told him that what I proposed to say here was very much the same thing, but he should go through it and tell me which parts of it I should eliminate so as not to, so to speak, tread on his toes. But he very generously didn't reply to that question. in listening to him, I now know what I can omit, and that is the wonderful background he has given us in connection with the British opposition to the slave trade. And the only one thing that I would add concerning Mr. Wilberforce, because he has already, I think, demonstrated to you how conservative on other issues Mr. Wilberforce was, is to tell you about his view as to whether it was proper and appropriate for women to be involved in the cause in which, and the propagation of the cause in which he was so devoted. This is what he said. For ladies to meet, to go from house to house, stirring up petitions, these appear to me proceedings unsuited to the feminine character as delineated in the scriptures. The struggle against the slave trade and slavery that was developed in Britain in particular is something about which I think people can legitimately take some pride, because it was the British government that was instrumental in, on a worldwide scale, suppressing the slave trade. They had actually been preceded by Denmark, but it was the power of the British Navy that was tremendously important in that respect. There's one aspect of the abolition of the slave trade that I would like to mention. It's very interesting that among those who were opposed to the continuation of the slave trade were some West Indian slave-owning planters. And this at first appears to be an anomaly, and of course one would assume, if one didn't go into the facts, the details, that this was a humanitarian development. But I'm afraid it was far more material than that. Trinidad had been a Spanish colony until it was occupied by Britain in 1798, And Spain was persuaded to cede the colony to Britain in 1802. The Spaniards had not developed a sugar industry in Trinidad on any appreciable scale. The explanation of this may be partly because there was an established cane sugar industry in Andalusia, in southern Spain. But for whatever reason, that is the case. But after Trinidad became a British possession, because of the excellent opportunities for production of sugarcane in the soil of Trinidad and the climate of Trinidad, persons moved in to establish sugarcane plantations. Now, sugar produced in a British colony entered the British market with duty concessions, because of being British. And had the sugar industry of Trinidad developed, that would have meant an increase in the supply of sugar entering the British market entitled to these duty concessions. And the hard-nosed sugar producers in the older colonies realized that this sort of competition might, in fact, because of the increase of sugar, lower the price of sugar and adversely affect them. In fact, sugar production in Trinidad, because the soil was virgin, might have been cheaper for them than production in the older sugar colonies. And so some of these plantation owners in the older colonies were prepared to lend their support to the idea of abolishing the slave trade so as to prevent their potential rivals from obtaining the labor supply they needed to develop the sugar industry. The colonies, the Dutch colonies of Demerara, Berbice, and Essequibo subsequently united to form British Guyana, were occupied by British forces in 1804, and although the Dutch did not cede the territory until 1814, British producers again moved in to the Guyana territories. The Dutch had developed a sugar industry, but mainly along the banks of the many mighty rivers. And after the occupation of the Guyana territories by the British, there was a big development of sugar plantations in the coastal lands. Here again, a labor supply was needed. And here again, some sugar producers in the older colonies saw the advantages of doing what they could to prevent their potential rivals for obtaining the labor, the slave labor they needed, by lending their support to the abolition of the slave trade. And so this explains the very curious fact that the movement for the abolition of the slave trade did enjoy some slave-owning planter support in the older colonies. Support which was given because by that support, if the slave trade were abolished, potential rivals would find it difficult to expand because they couldn't then obtain the slave labor they required. In the event, of course, the new planting fraternity in Trinidad and in the Guyanas did find a way to get around this, because when the slave trade was abolished from 1808, and as you can see, if Trinidad was only ceded in 1802 and the Guyana colonies were only occupied in 1804, they didn't have much time to get in an adequate supply of slave labor. But the way that problem was circumvented was by looking for an alternative source of labor. And that led to the development of the importation of what is known as indentured labor, theoretically free labor. The word indenture is interesting. In those early days, contracts written on parchment were written in duplicate on the same sheet. And then a pair of scissors was used to separate the two copies in a line which went like that. A line which was indented. And so afterwards, it was possible to find out whether a copy of a contract was genuine by comparing it with the original to see whether the two fitted together. And that is the curious origin of the word indentured labor. It's somehow very strange and even amusing how history develops. And these indentured laborers, free, supposedly free, but bound by a contract requiring them to work at a fixed wage for a fixed period of years, was developed on a massive scale, and eventually the source of the labor which was most prolific was in from depressed areas in India. Now that has an interesting consequence in West Indian history, because whereas the population of Jamaica is, and of course the population of Barbados, Antigua, St. Kitts, Leeward Islands, Dominica, is overwhelmingly of African origin. In Jamaica, for example, the number of the population, the percentage of people whose origin is the Indian subcontinent, is a maximum of 3%. But Trinidad, at least 40% of the population is of East Indian origin. And in Guyana, persons of East Indian origin exceed 50%. So there's that very interesting difference in the composition of the populations of the older colonies, Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua, St. Kitts, St. Lucia, well, not St. Lucia, St. Vincent, and the colonies of Trinidad and British Guyana. Now, I can, because of the excellent lecture that you've heard from my predecessor, move on to the actual abolition of slavery itself. Usually, the propaganda exercise that people have been subjected to has been designed to reflect the great credit due to Britain in the abolition of the slave trade and slavery. But if we look at the proposal put forward by the founders of the movement for the abolition of slavery, we then begin to question as to whether as much credit as is traditionally given is really due. The Society for the Abolition of Slavery, popularly known as the Abolition Society, was founded in 1823. Wilberforce, whom you've heard of, was one of the persons interested in this movement, as was, of course, Clarkson. But the spokesman in Parliament in 1823 was Thomas Fowell Buxton. And Buxton put forward an interesting idea for the abolition of slavery. He said, "Let us agree on a date after which all children born shall be born free." He never actually got around in that debate to proposing a date, but he proposed that there should be agreement on a date. Those who are already alive on that date and in slavery should remain slaves for the remainder of their natural lives. That was the proposal he put forward. It is interesting, as I say, that the actual name of the society should be remembered. It was a society for the gradual abolition of slavery. But he proposed that if this scheme were adopted, then slavery would die out. As he put it, it will subside, it will decline, it will expire, it will, as it were, burn itself down into its sockets and go out. We shall leave it gently to decay, slowly, silently, almost imperceptibly, to die away and to be forgotten. Well, okay, it was a proposal for the abolition of slavery, but how long would it have taken? How long would it have taken to work itself through? I think I'm being generous when I suggest a minimum of 50 years. But Buxton withdrew that proposal when the government of the day agreed to take up the issue and propose the abolition of slavery. And so Buxton's proposal was withdrawn in favor of this resolution, which was moved on behalf of the government by George Canning, that it is expedient to adopt effective and decisive measures for the ameliorating the condition of the slave population of His Majesty's colonies, that through a determined and persevering, but at the same time judicious and temperate enforcement of such measures, this House looks forward to a progressive improvement in the character of the slave population, such as may prepare them for a participation of these civil rights and privileges which are enjoyed by other classes of His Majesty's subjects. That this House is anxious for the accomplishment of this purpose at the earliest period that shall be compatible with the well-being of the slaves themselves, with the safety of the colonies, and with a fair and equitable consideration of the interests of private property. So that was the decision of Parliament in 1823. How long would that have taken to work its way through, to reach the point where the members of Parliament were satisfied that the slaves were sufficiently improved in character to enjoy freedom? Am I being unfair if I suggest a century? And yet, 10 years later, Parliament enacted the legislation which brought the system of slavery to an end. How is this to be explained? It seems to me that it's inevitable that the conclusion must be reached that it was the intervention of the slaves themselves that expedited the process. Throughout the history of slavery, there were many rebellions and conspiracies for rebellion, all of which were suppressed. Hardly a year passed without some rebellion occurring in some part of the Caribbean area colonies. But it was in the 19th century that the most significant rebellions occurred. One of the rebellions that really shook the establishment to the roots was a rebellion in Barbados, of all places, in 1816. Barbados has no mountainous interior to which escaped slaves could escape and establish themselves, as had happened in Jamaica and in Suriname. Many of you, of course, will have heard of the Jamaican Maroons, the word Maroon being derived from the Spanish cimarron, or wild man. The Maroon Wars in Jamaica, where escaped slaves fought a war successfully for 10 years, at the end of which the establishment gave them a written treaty of peace guaranteeing their freedom and land. There were five Maroon establishments in Jamaica arising out of two treaties. And those Maroon settlements, three of them are still in existence in Jamaica today. The Acompong Maroons, in fact, are still not paying taxes on land.
That's right. All right.
The other two Maroon settlements are not quite so fortunate. They obtained their freedom, they obtained land, but they pay taxes. The Maroons, of course, were pioneers in this struggle for freedom, winning it in battle and maintaining their freedom in prolonged wars. But the British government is not to be that easily disposed of, to leave such a dangerous, rebellious center within their country without making use of it. And so, very cleverly, the establishment was able to offer the Maroons, those of them who would participate, offer them the opportunity to earn considerable rewards after the treaties had been signed by rounding up other runaway slaves and returning them to their masters. And so this magnificent achievement in a fight for freedom, in fact, has been tarnished by the acceptance of large numbers of Maroons of the opportunity to earn rewards by helping to suppress subsequent slave rebellions. In fact, there was a rather awkward situation developing in Jamaica, because initially the rewards offered for rounding up runaway slaves provided a higher rate of payment for those slaves who were killed in battle. And some Maroons saw the opportunity of converting rebellious slaves whom they defeated and captured alive, of putting them to death so as to obtain the higher reward. And so the government had to change the system and provide a larger reward for those rebellious slaves who were captured and returned to their owners alive, and for those who were killed, a lower reward. But the slave rebellions continued despite the settlement of the Maroon treaties. And those rebellions occurred throughout the region. In Guyana, there was a massive rebellion in 1823. The Barbados Rebellion was supposed to have involved 5,000 slaves. The Guyana Rebellion was supposed to have involved 23,000 slaves. But the largest of all the rebellions was the Emancipation Rebellion, which occurred in Jamaica, commencing in December 1831, which was finally suppressed by April 1832. And that involved even more slaves. I told you Guyana was 23,000, I beg your pardon, it was 13,000 in Guyana. That involved 20,000 slaves in western Jamaica. The organizer of that rebellion was a remarkable man. His name was Sam Sharp, which he had taken from his owner, Samuel Sharp Esquire. One of the things, the injustices that the system of slavery inflicted on the people, was that they lost their original names. They lost their African names. For example, my own ancestry. I can tell you the names for several generations back of my Jewish ancestry. I can trace the ancestry of a couple of generations for my either English or Scottish, I'm not sure which. But my African ancestry I know nothing about, because the record was erased entirely of African names. And although I have been able to find in my research the areas of Africa from which large numbers of slaves were brought to Jamaica, and the names of tribes and so on, surnames are impossible to trace. That is one of the injustices. And yet, the subsequent importation of labor from India, at least the Indians did not suffer that indignity.
Yeah.
Their names and even their religions were not exterminated, and the names of West Indians of Indian origin can still be traced back to their original ancestral names. Now, let me tell you something about the Jamaica Rebellion of 1831-32, the Emancipation Rebellion. Fortunately, there was a Methodist minister in Jamaica at the time, the Reverend Henry Bleeby, who saw the significance and who took the trouble to hold extensive interviews with the organizer of the rebellion, Sam Sharp, whilst he was in custody awaiting execution. Bleeby records his interviews with Sharp, and I'd just like to read to you what Bleeby says. In his book, Death Struggles of Slavery, Bleeby wrote, "The insurrection was planned by the person and that individual, by one person, and that individual himself a slave. Samuel Sharp was the man whose active brain devised the project, and he had sufficient authority with those around him to carry it into effect. Having acquired an extraordinary degree of influence amongst his fellow slaves, I had much conversation with him whilst he was confined and found him certainly the most intelligent and remarkable slave I have ever met with." He continues, "Sharp acknowledged to me that he had, as an individual, no reason to find fault with the treatment he had received as a slave. His master, Samuel Sharp Esquire, and the family were always very kind to him, and he had never been flogged beyond the occasional and slight correction which he had received when a boy. But he thought that he learned from his Bible that the whites had no more right to hold black people in slavery than black people had to make the white people slaves. And for his own part, he would rather die than live in slavery." Now that tells you something very interesting. Sharp's motivation is largely religious. And that means that he has absorbed some of the teachings on Christianity that the nonconformist missionaries have been proclaiming. For the most part, the Church of England did not proselytize the slaves to the same extent that the Baptists, Methodists, and Moravians did. But Sharp was a lay preacher and very often conducted services in outlying districts because he was allowed a good deal of latitude for such activities by his religious owner. is a resolution which was passed by the legislature at the end of their inquiry into the rebellion on the 5th of April 1832. And it reveals the ideological conviction rather than personal suffering as a motivating factor that inspired many of the rebel leaders. The resolution reads, "Resolved that it has been a remarkable and unprecedented feature in this rebellion that many of the chief conspirators and ringleaders were to be found amongst those slaves who had from their situations as head people or confidential servants were the least worked, were the best clothed, and received the most indulgence." So this is very interesting. The ideological aspect of the opposition to slavery and willingness to rebel that existed in Jamaica during that revolution. Here is the story of one of Sharpe's fellow conspirators that was given to the Reverend Henry Beebe, which he also recorded. This is a man who was, in fact, he was one of the principal supporters of Sharpe. During the year 1831, he could not tell the month. He received a message at Mountain Spring from Sam Sharpe, desiring him to meet him on the following Saturday night at the house of John Johnson at Retrieve Estate in St. James. And he was the Colonel Johnson who led the attack and was killed at Mount Pelion. At the time appointed, Hilton went to Retrieve, where he met with Sharpe, Johnson, and others, whom he named. After they had held a prayer meeting, most of the people went away. Sharpe, Johnson, Hilton, and a few more remained behind, and the party was afterwards enlarged by several others who stealthily and with extreme caution made their way into the house and who were evidently expected by those already assembled. After the lapse of some time, Sharpe rose to address the meeting, speaking in a low voice, soft tone, that his voice might not be heard beyond the walls of the building. He then proceeded with his address to those around him, speaking for a long time on the various topics relating to the great subject he had at heart, and with an eloquence which, from Hilton's account, kept all his hearers fascinated and spellbound from the beginning to the end of his speech. He referred to the many manifold evils and injustices of slavery, asserting the natural equality of man with regard to freedom, and referring to the Holy Scriptures as his authority, denied that the white man had any more right to hold the blacks in bondage than the blacks had to enslave the whites. he concluded by observing that because the king had made them free, or was resolved upon doing it, the whites and Grignon were holding secret meetings with the doors shut close at the house of Mr. Watt of Montego Bay, and had determined to kill all the black men and save all the women and children and keep them in slavery. And if the black men did not stand up for for themselves and take their freedom, the whites would put them out at the muzzles of their guns and shoot them like pigeons. Well, that's a very interesting remark, because the rumor that the king had actually decided to free them but was being prevented from doing so by the slave owners is interesting. It was a ploy which, if Sharp believed it, I would be surprised. But certainly it was a good organizational point, because people had been indoctrinated to hold the monarchy in great respect. Further discussion ensued, and their deliberations were carried on far into the night, when all scruples being set at rest and the plan of operations more fully detailed by Sharp, the whole party bound themselves by oath not to work after Christmas as slaves, but to assert their claim to freedom and to be faithful to each other. If Bakra would pay them, they would work as before. But if any attempt was made to force them to work as slaves, then they would fight for their freedom. Now, this is also an interesting question, because the purpose that Sharp put forward before the slaves was virtually the calling of a general strike against any continuation of work as a slave, but not the overthrow of the government or the seizure of the property of the slave owners, which of course distinguishes the Jamaican Rebellion from the Great Haitian Rebellion, which had occurred in the neighboring island of Saint-Domingue. Whether Sharp thought that it was possible that the establishment would surrender to their demands, or he knew that they would refuse and that rebellion would be necessary, is an interesting question. He was such an intelligent man that the probabilities are that he knew in advance that rebellion was the result which would have to be adopted. Bleeby thinks that Sharp was very much more aware of the situation than that extract from his speech would suggest. Bibi wrote, he did not wish to destroy the estates, nor did he desire that any person should be injured. His only object was to obtain freedom, but to his great disappointment, he found that the spirit of revolt, once evoked, was not susceptible of control. So Bleeby seems to think that Sharp may have expected the possibility of success of the strike. then again, Bibi questions that. He says, Sharp was not deceived himself concerning the slavery question. He was, I believe, too intelligent not to be aware of the true state of the case. Living in the town of Montego Bay, where he had frequent opportunities of reading the newspapers containing reports of the movement of the anti-slavery party in England, he knew very well how matters stood both in England and in the colony. But being favoured by the absence of the minister, Mr. Burchell, from the island, he formed the daring design of imposing upon the slaves. In that part of the island, the belief that they had actually been made free by the king, and of putting himself at the head of a their head to commence a struggle for freedom. Bibi writes further, the powerful influence which Sharp exercised over the people around him will appear from the fact that he succeeded in enlisting several free men in the struggle. Two persons called McIntosh, father and son, another named Largie, and a person named Campbell, all men of colour, were implicated, and with the exception of Largie, were executed, being actively concerned in the insurrection. Now, finally, Bibi and others sum up the result of the rebellion. He writes, at first, shooting was the favorite mode of execution, and many were thus disposed of. But when the novelty of this had ceased, the gallows was put into requisition. And then he gives an account of the many hangings that took place. Bibi was impressed by the manner in which so many of those awaiting execution conducted themselves. He writes, the undaunted bravery and fortitude with which many of the insurgents met their fate formed a very remarkable feature of the transactions of the period, and strikingly indicated the difficulty attending upon the maintenance of slavery now that the spirit of freedom had gone abroad and many of the Negroes had learned to prefer death to bondage. And he writes further, Sharp was the last victim that was put to death for taking part in the insurrection. He was executed at Montego Bay on the 23rd of May 1832. For several weeks before his execution, the magistrate had prohibited our visits. But the last time I conversed with Sharp, he repeated his expressions of sorrow that he had been the cause of so much mischief. He was not, however, to be convinced that he had done wrong in endeavoring to assert his claim to freedom. Two assessments. Bibi gives a further account of the execution itself, which I won't weary you with. But I'd like to give you two assessments of the effect of the rebellion. As I said, it was in fact forcibly suppressed. This is Nebe's assessment. The revolt failed of accomplishing the immediate purpose of its author. Yet by it, a further wound was dealt to slavery, which accelerated its destruction. For it demonstrated to the imperial legislature that among the Negroes themselves, the spirit of freedom had been so widely diffused as to render it most perilous to postpone the settlement of the most important question of emancipation to a later period. The evidence taken before the committee of the two Houses of Parliament made it manifest that if the abolition of slavery were not speedily effected by the peaceable method of legislative enactment, the slaves would assuredly take the matter into their own hands and bring their bondage to a violent and bloody termination. And a similar assessment, but from a very different point of view, comes from a military officer who was engaged, this is Bernard Martin Sr., who was engaged in the suppression of the rebellion. He puts it this way: it will not be surprising that so propitious a circumstance as the late rebellion should be seized with avidity for their furtherance and immediate accomplishment. A bill was brought into Parliament by which it was enacted that all slavery should cease throughout the British dominions on the 1st of August 1834. Well, those are the assessments of the effect of the rebellion, a rebellion which was, as always, suppressed, but which caused a rethinking of the speed with which slavery should be brought to an end, and caused Parliament to enact the legislation to that effect. The first bill provided that the slaves would, on the 1st of August 1834, be converted from slaves to apprentices. This was a nice way of making the process more acceptable. They were to work for their owners free of charge for 40 and a half hours per week, and if required to work beyond that, they were to be paid for their services at rates to be negotiated. Possibility of negotiating between slave and slave owner is not a matter which the legislators considered. The slaves took a very dim view of this method of gradual emancipation, because for predial slaves, that is, field slaves, it was to last for 6 years, and for all other slaves it was to last for 4 years, at the end of which the abolition of slavery was to be complete. But the slaves took a very dim view of this and virtually made the apprenticeship system unworkable. In fact, the plantation owners in Antigua themselves saw that it would be unworkable, and they resolved not to adopt it, but to proceed to complete emancipation on the 1st of August 1834. the plantation owners in Montserrat were also doubtful, but a resolution for immediate emancipation was lost on the casting vote of the Speaker. In St. Kitts, the slaves broke out in rebellion, and the British government came to the conclusion that in fact it was not working, and encouraged, they first of all introduced complete abolition of slavery in the Crown colonies of Trinidad and St. Lucia from the 1st of August 1838, and they encouraged the self-governing older colonies to adopt a similar proposal, which they did, and all of them agreed to terminate slavery, terminate the system of slavery completely on the 1st of August 1838. The slaves received no compensation for their centuries of enslavement, but the slave owners were very generously compensated by the British Parliament, who voted £20,000 to be paid out to them in compensation for their loss. Now, that seems to me to be the important point, that the system of slavery was changed to a system of wage labour, but the ownership of property remained exactly where it had always been, and the slaves were given the opportunity now to continue on the plantations and work for wages, or to leave the plantations and seek other opportunities of remaining alive. But it does seem to me irrefutable that it was the rebellious activity of the slaves themselves who made the abolition of slavery a matter that could not be indefinitely postponed, but had to be immediately addressed. That is why I have called my books on the subject, I've given them the title Slaves Who Abolished Slavery.
That's right.